Thank God, straight zombie takeouts are still in style.
Hello, and welcome to Zombie Takeout, the B-movie and cult movie show. I'm John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we've got some feedback from Bodo in reference to last week's review, Hardcore Henry. He said, at Zombie Takeout, wow, I was surprised that John liked Hardcore Henry. I was disappointed with Scott. What the hell? I'm turning 54 this past Saturday. I'm not quite sure how that works. Shameless birthday plug. And I thought it would be, I thought it would have been John being mad at the movie. First off, I said this on Twitter, but once again, happy belated birthday, Bodo.
Happy birthday.
And also, as I mentioned last time, years of watching Let's Plays prepared me. It was just in a long cutscene.
And I enjoyed most of it, but was just pissed off when he cryptid the fight scene at the end.
Mm-hmm. And some news. Nigel Bock, director of Bad Ben, has set up a GoFundMe page to raise money for the next installment of the series. And I think it's called Bad Ben Downloaded. That's at least the name on the GoFundMe page.
I'm trying to remember. Did we do the second Bad Ben movie?
We've done the first Bad Ben Santa. And we did Bad Santa as one of the Halloween shorts.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we so haven't done any other.
We really need to get to the other Bad Ben then.
Yeah, we do. He said on the page that he can make it with what he has now, but it would be a lot easier if he made some computer upgrades.
He
has, you know, a price list of, or actually, like, it looks like it's from the Mac, a screenshot from the Apple Store of, like, what he wants. A fairly high-end Mac Mini and an airport backup. So he's, you know, doing a GoFundMe page. Links will be in the description. And with that out of the way, on to this week's movie, which is from 1980, Dressed to Kill. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Shower Scenes, the perfect excuse for random nudity. Try one in your next film.
And also brought to you by Psychobabble, because sometimes a little bit of knowledge can be a very dangerous thing for an entire movie.
Oh, yeah. I was a psych major, and I actually started therapy a couple of months ago, so those therapy scenes were painful.
Did you do, like, a spit take, though, at the end of that last scene, though?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was just, like, what? Anyway. Not in, like, oh, my God, that came out of left field thing, but, well, like, I felt like it was a, you know, you... points deducted and may God have mercy on your soul.
I'm fully expecting you to rant about the ending.
I was like, maybe it was too harsh on Hardcore Henry about halfway through this thing.
Wow.
All right, so impromptu plot summary here. And by the way, we're that just so bad at business that the only time we ask our listeners for money is to send it to someone else that's completely unrelated to us. But hey, we get to have funny ads
we have a store somewhere that we never talk about.
We do. You can get Zombie Takeout, you know, merch.
Check the sidebar on zombietakeout.com.
I forgot all about that. I should get some. Anyway. Anyway, so we have a shrink. Well, actually, we start off with a woman who is, where would she be in this movie?
A Brian De Palma movie.
Let me think. What could she possibly be doing? Oh, I know. She's in the shower. And her husband is just oblivious to her. And just shaving, of course, with everybody uses those straight fucking razors back in 1980. I don't know. But anyway. So he's oblivious to her. He's not giving it to her good enough. And so she's, of course, seeking the help of a shrink, because that's why people seek the help of a shrink, I guess. I don't know.
Well, in some cases, but before that, the shower scene does get kind of interesting.
She fantasizes about being raped in the shower.
Yes.
Now, was it being by him, by her husband, or by somebody else? I
wasn't sure about that.
All the dudes look very similar in this movie, by the way.
Well, it is 1980, so we're still kind of on Planet 70s.
Right. But, like, the dude in the museum, the husband, they could have all been played by the same guy, for all I know.
Michael Caine is the only one who was at all distinct.
And even him, he kind of, I mean, if he...
Well, yeah, he was very much the 70s guy.
Right. I mean, he had very similar hairstyle. I think he just didn't wear sunglasses like the dude in the museum, which, yeah. Who the fuck wears sunglasses in a museum to check out art, by the way? Anyway.
They were one of those, you know, ones that change when you come inside and they were just taking them off.
It was like 30 years before those were invented, though. but anyway, she goes to the shrink. She tries to seduce the shrink. The shrink, of course, you know, resists, and so she leaves. And that's when she gets to the museum, and this ridiculously long, drawn-out scene that has absolutely zero bearing on the plot takes place.
It just puts her in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's literally all it does.
And I don't know about you, but it was pretty obvious to figure out who the killer was before even anybody was killed within the first reel of the fucking movie.
I'm curious what your signs were, because I didn't pick up on it. But
I just did. It was just like, it was like watching that old episode of Matlock with, oh, and here's, like, you know, the celebrity, you know, the B-list celebrity or whatever is on, oh, yeah, and the guest star. You're like, I wonder who the murderer is. Yes, she has this ridiculous cat and mouse game with this dude at the museum who they wind up, of course, fucking in a cab and then back at his place. And then there's an even another long drawn out scene about, oh, how embarrassing this is. And, you know, how, what kind of note should I leave him, kind of thing. And just all this nonsense, because she, well, spoiler alert, winds up getting killed right away, which,
not right away. That was like a half hour into the movie, after Jesus. About 20 minutes of silence.
It felt like an eternity, though, honestly. But yeah, it felt like a good hour and a half. But yeah, you're right. It was only a half hour into this that she got killed. And you do see that it is obviously a dude in drag killing her. And right, so... The person that, of course, who I thought was put into the best performance of this movie, or at least the most captivating performance, because all the actors are doing what they can with it. But the one who I thought who stands out above them, of course, Mr. Dennis Franz.
Absolutely. The only good part of the movie was his scenes.
As this detective who just could give a fuck less about anything. Mm-hmm. And
it's Dennis Franz being Dennis Franz, but in this movie, it was so refreshing.
Right. It was, because all the other dudes just looked alike almost, except for maybe the son, who was this, the whiz kid. It was just, fuck, which all of that, I thought of the phrase Mr. Wizard before it was even spoken, too. Oh, I was this is just, my notes actually say, holy, like, this Mr. Wizard stuff is annoying, and then after that, holy shit, she actually used Mr. Wizard.
Well, it's not exactly an obscure reference, especially in 1980.
Right. So he, there was a prostitute that witnessed the murder, or at least was at the tail end of it, and was almost
conveniently handed the murder weapon.
Yes. Gets handed the murder weapon. Interesting. And, of course, the detective leans on her to solve the crime for him.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand how that works. And this is so just convoluted. You can tell how...
Yeah, she ends up running from this gang and running from the killer.
Right. She runs from a gang and a killer at the same time. And
teams up with the son to try to solve the murder.
She starts hitting on the son, like, immediately, of course, even like, oh, your mom just died. Let me start hitting on you now. You know what? The phrase that comes to mind with this movie, I think of an old Bloodhound Gang lyric, is as deep as the plot of an amateur gay porn.
Yep. There's a bit at the end of the murder, you know, when after Angie Dickinson's character gets killed, and you see her hand kind of sticking out of the elevator all bloody, and yeah. The elevator door is just repeatedly closing on it. That was emblematic of my feelings about the movie.
Or was he like, he was still in the elevator with her, wasn't she? Wasn't
he? I think he may have been, yeah.
He was killing her as the door was closing because they were like in the basement and the prostitute somehow misses it. But anyway, they do the whole Scooby-Doo thing and reveal who it is that the killer is, but the detective had been trailing her all along, just using her as bait, and oh, what fun times they had, mm-hmm. and hilarity ensues.
Yeah. And the movie starts off with this long, protracted bit of music over the credits that is like a bargain basement version of the theme from A Summer's Place.
Yeah.
That keeps playing throughout the movie, just making it all the more intolerable.
Yeah.
And then it's a shower scene with some very unexpected close-ups until I remembered that it's a De Palma movie. That led right into a sex scene. Again, De Palma. And I'm reasonably sure that Napoleon didn't invent the pastry Napoleon. Dickinson's character claims that at one point in the movie.
Yeah, I took that with a grain of salt.
Well, I actually did look it up. I the history of the dish is unknown. Is kind of unknown.
I'm a fan of Napoleon's.
It existed before the military, the general Napoleon.
Okay.
He did not invent it. Now on to the therapy scenes, because both patients end up hitting on him.
They do.
And Nancy Allen's characters both end up hitting on him. And he admits that he's attracted to both of them. And the only reason he doesn't sleep... Well, he says he doesn't sleep with them because they're his patients and because he's married. But admitting the attraction is just incredibly unprofessional.
Who knows what the therapy was like back in the
patient's,
day.
A patient says that you steer clear. You divert.
Yeah.
You do anything you can to avoid that.
I would think that you would have to go to another doctor then.
Well, yeah, if that is said, then yes, you should. If the doctor says they find you attractive, yes, you should probably find another doctor.
Well, I was thinking if the patient finds the doctor attractive, they should have to go to another doctor.
I mean, there's transference, which is fairly common. You can work through that. But, you know, don't expect anything. Anyway, now on to the museum scene.
Oh, my God.
Doing 10 minutes without any dialogue. I timed it.
And I mean, I get it. I get what he was trying to do there, but who gives a fuck about her trying to pick up this dude in a museum?
Yeah,
it was just the most nonsensical thing you could draw upon.
And a lot of focus on this photo of a gorilla laying down. And really, the only significant dialogue in the first half hour of the movie is the therapy scene.
There was also a cool shot of the World Trade Center at 23 and a half minutes. I don't know if you noticed that.
No, but okay.
Well, it's like a street scene, and then the two towers are just like over the, in the back over everything else, because they were like the tallest thing in the area.
By the time she woke up at his place and started debating over the notes, and we get that ridiculous shot of her kind of smiling listlessly, but not listlessly, but smiling kind of, you know, romantically with the shot of her panties in the cab.
Yeah.
Screen. By that point, I was just really looking forward to her murder. I knew she was going to buy it. I was just looking forward to it. I wasn't sure when. Conveniently, it was in the next scene. But I did get a kick out of her going through his drawers and seeing the medical report from the doctor saying that he has syphilis and gonorrhea.
Right, just leaving that note lying around.
But the silence was just unbearable.
I would think that would be a good thing if you had like an actual dramatic thing going on. Oh, yeah. You know, like that's a life or death situation.
It can be played well. Like, but this movie did not do it.
If there, yeah, like I said, if there was a life or death situation at play and you had the silence and you, it would be really an intense thing. But about the social embarrassment of hitting on a dude or oh, I left my panties in the taxi.
Or the gag for a big chunk of it is she drops a glove in when she's sitting next to him in the museum. He picks it up. She walks off. He comes up behind her, taps her on the shoulder with the glove to kind of say, you know, you dropped this. She just runs off scared, goes back to where she left it, and then is walking around the museum for like what felt like 5 minutes straight looking for it until she walks out and sees his cap. And then rando guy grabs her and they fuck in the cap.
Just unbearable. Just an unbearable waste of time and adds absolutely zero to the film.
But it leads to the best parts of the film, her murder. Brian De Palma has said that the murder in the elevator is the best thing he's ever filmed.
Now, really, I mean, it just, it kind of pisses me off because it is the old horror cliche that, oh, she's morally strayed, so we have to punish her. Yeah. And having the venereal disease and the embarrassment isn't enough. She needs to be murdered.
And let's, the moral bullshit in this movie, let's get, you know, Michael Caine's character, the therapist, isn't just a guy in drag, he's trans.
Right.
Someone who's trans is the killer because they're trans.
Right.
Largely, that was the explanation. He's trans.
Exactly. My jaw dropped when that was the explanation that he was trans. And they pretty much made it sound like every trans person had a personality disorder of some sort of a masculine and versus the feminine. And I was like, ugh.
And he's institutionalized. Even though he's a therapist, he's institutionalized. I'm not sure how that works.
I don't know either, but I mean, you'd imagine he's going to be institutionalized if he committed murder.
Well, no, but I thought he was institutionalized to begin with. Or was he just a patient of that other doctor?
Yeah, he was a patient of that other doctor, but he wasn't institutionalized until he actually committed murder. Right. And then that fantasy sequence at the end is just, oh my God.
Yeah. And things the movie says about the mentally ill, I don't even want to get started on. But on to the only good part. Well, one of the very few good parts of the movie, the best part of the movie, Dennis Franz. A wonderful surprise to see him in. Because I think I'd seen this movie many years ago, but I'd totally forgotten most of it. So I was very happy to see Dennis Franz show up, just being Dennis Franz.
Just being this asshole.
Really the only thoroughly enjoyable part of the movie. I did enjoy the split-screen phone calls with Nancy Allen's character and Dr. Elliot, Michael Caine's character. They're both on the phone and they kind of split screen it, kind of like what he did in Sisters.
Yeah.
To Palma. And they both end up watching Donahue interviewing a trans woman.
And I was wondering, I mean, he'd at least seen this thing of Donahue. So was he just mocking the Donahue thing then? I mean,
I have no idea. I get the impression it just seemed irrelevant. So I put it in there.
Right. Like, it's just shocking that somebody would make a film about something they knew so little about.
Yeah. Even the title of the film is transphobic. Dressed to Kill.
Yeah.
As if it's just clothes you put on. Like, as if he was just a crossdresser.
Right.
But they go out of their way to say he's trans.
I mean, at least I think it was Roger Ebert that said that last scene in Psycho is one of the worst scenes in cinematic history where they sit down and spoon feed
straight dialogue, straight exposition.
But at least, if I'm remembering right, there at least was actual validity to what they were saying.
It all worked.
He was actually talking about personality disorders. And it was, I mean, it was way ahead of its time. And this is like, what, 15 years later?
Yeah, and it's just transphobic bullshit.
It might as well have been the last speech at Billy Madison.
Yeah,
exactly. It was really that bad. Yeah, yeah. It was just that stupid.
Incidentally, when an interview suggested to Sir Alfred Hitchcock that Dressed to Kill was meant to be an homage to him, Hitchcock replied, "You mean fromage."
Yeah, I was trying to look up to see what his opinion of this was. He died the year this came out, though. So I guess he did. I guess he did see it.
But, I mean, I checked multiple sources for that quote, and it came up. So I'm gonna guess it's legit.
Oh, that's great.
And that's the only time I probably pronounced that word homage correctly on this show, because I had to have it right. You mean fromage? I will say the chase through the subway cars was interesting. She ends up surrounded by this gang who are about to rape her. She runs. She gets away. Gets onto a subway car. The killer and the gang both end up on the car.
I was hoping the killer and the gang were going to go at it.
Yeah, that would have been fun.
Yeah, I mean, but this whole thing of her getting in with the gang, it kind of reminded me of Hardcore Henry, actually. Because this absurd, like, oh, now they're going to fight them too kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was just as realistic.
And the bit of exposition at the end is followed up by this lecture about being transgender, which was also just crowbarred in, slightly a bit more accurate than the explanation, but and then Liz agrees to stay with Peter for a while.
Oh yeah,
which again makes no sense. I didn't get the impression she was hitting on him. She was, you know, because he's well. They don't give his age. He's a teenager, but you know.
I thought they were gonna get it on like right away, honestly. But I mean, it seems like they waited till like later, because like, wait, when she woke up from the dream, they were in bed together, weren't they?
Were they? I didn't get that. I didn't notice.
I thought they were.
Oh, could have been. Incidentally, I'm surprised you're not ranting that whole bit turned out to be a dream. I mean, not the entire movie, but that bit.
Well, right. End. And that was. Where to begin on that? I mean, the dream itself was just so shitty. It was like this, yeah, and they're just going to put him in some institution where he can just get out anyway and go and do whatever he wants. And it's all dark and people are just leering at stuff and cheering him on. Right. And then to be, you know, it was all just a dream sort of thing. On top of that, which is just one of the worst sins you could do in a movie.
Yeah. Nancy Allen earned both a Golden Globe nomination for Best New Star and a Razzie nomination.
Well, you know, every actor in this, I can't really say anything bad about, honestly.
I really can't compare it to other things she's done because it's been a long time, but...
None of the performances I thought were that bad. I think they just had real shit script to work with. I mean, I'll give you the elevator scene in this. The elevator scene is fucking disturbing as hell.
But it's still very psycho. It's still, you know, replace the shower curtain with the elevator door, and it's the same thing.
I mean, he was even trying to knock the psycho music off, too. Exactly. It's just embarrassing.
Yeah, and fortunately no sequels, and I don't really see a remake happening these days. It's the remake is not going to happen because it's like, just too transphobic to be done these days.
Well, right, I guess if they did a remake it would be grounded in reality. I don't know, like
just let it go.
Just yeah, this
on the brains.
Oh yeah, on the brains, we're already there.
Yeah, it's so fast. I'm giving it one brain for Dennis Franz, half a brain for Nancy Allen, shower scene, 1.5.
I mean, you know, it's the elevator scene, you got some decent performances. You've got some nice eye candy in there. And however, though, and to be fair, since I did remove a brain for Hardcore Harry ripping off one scene... Uh-huh. I've got to take something off for this just complete ripoff of Hitchcock. Right. I mean, Hitchcock was still alive while he was filming this, so it's not like this is some tribute to him.
Yeah.
This is just, I mean, this is worse than Sisters. You know, Sisters had elements of Hitchcock.
Yeah, I kind of like Sisters. I mean, the big twist at the end made it for me.
Right, but there still seemed like an original thing going on there. Where this, it was all just, it was almost a remake of Psycho, the shot-for-shot remake almost. And so yeah, I'm going one brain.
All right, and what have we learned?
That Angie Dickinson and Nancy Allen could be the only reasons they let De Palma keep making films after this.
Yeah, and I learned that silence isn't always golden.
I mean, I like Scarface and The Untouchables, so it's good that they did, but wow.
Incidentally, a bit of trivia that I remember, didn't have it in my notes. Sean Connery was going to play Dr. Elliot at first, but he couldn't because of other commitments.
Nor wanted to dress in drag, maybe?
No, he was very excited for the role.
Really?
He was really into it. He just had other commitments come up, so he couldn't do it. And Michael Caine was cast.
But yeah, I mean, at first I thought it was obvious just about the guest star thing. And then when they did the scene of, let's go to my office so he can get in touch with her, you know, that when he's talking to the psychiatrist, I was kind of like, yeah, I know what's going on here.
I didn't see it coming. I think that reveal was, again, one of the few interesting parts of the movie. Anyway, that's it for Dressed to Kill, thankfully. Until next time, when we'll be reviewing Demolition Man. I have fond memories of the movie, so I think I might enjoy it. You've been very vocal about not enjoying it at all.
After this one, though.
Might be a step up, yeah. Until then, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life,
there you are.